Good evening, and welcome to the Complete Guide to Social Security Disability. This webinar and tele-learning series is brought to you by CanDo Multiple Sclerosis and the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. It is the third in a four-part series looking at employment issues and MS. My name is Laura Coyne, and I'm the Programs Manager for CanDo MS. Your moderator this evening is Christina Forster, the Employment Services Manager for the Greater Delaware Valley Chapter of the National MS Society. CanDo MS is an innovative provider of lifestyle empowerment programs for people living with MS and their support partners. Through our programs, we empower people to manage their disease and move beyond their MS by adopting active and healthy lifestyle behaviors. Please visit the CanDo MS website, mscandu.org, to learn more about CanDo MS's online and nationwide in-person programs. CanDo MS is excited to partner with the National MS Society to bring you 15 webinars in 2016. At this time, I would like to introduce Christina Forster.
Good evening, everybody. The mission of the National MS Society is to help people affected by MS live their best lives as we stop MS in its tracks, restore what has been lost, and end MS forever. We are pleased to have you join us in tonight's program. You can also explore other society programs, services, resources, and connection opportunities at nationalmssociety.org. Tonight, we'll hear from two experts who can provide some clarity around these issues and much more. Jamie Hall is the founder of the Law Office of Jamie R. Hall, a firm with a focus on Social Security disability and private long-term disability claims. Jamie's office is based out of Westchester, Pennsylvania, but is a nationwide service. He has handled hundreds of disability claims in 17 states. Jamie is a graduate of the Villanova Law School, and he is an avid supporter of the National MS Society, frequently donating his time and energy to the Society's efforts, including providing seminars, attending medical conferences, and serving as a corporate sponsor on MS Walk and MS Bike. Amy Wallish is the founder and CEO of Full Circle Employment Solutions, which is a leading provider of benefits, counseling, and employment services for people with disabilities. She is an innovative training professional passionate about encouraging people in their return to work and gaining financial freedom. Amy has trained across the country on Social Security benefits and asset development. She has an MBA and is trained through Social Security Administration as a community work incentive coordinator. I'm now going to turn over the program to Jamie to begin the presentation. Welcome, Jamie.
Thank you, Christina. My role this evening is to go ahead and talk about what we typically think of when a person says they're on disability. And those are the two Social Security programs out there covering the disability field. The first program I want to talk about is Social Security Disability Insurance, or SSDI. That is the most typical program we think of when someone says they're on disability. As you may know, it's a federal program. If you look at your paychecks and you see a withdrawal for a federal Social Security fund, part of that money goes towards Social Security Disability Insurance. As far as the program is concerned, they have a few items they look for. The first thing to look for is, do you have a sufficient disabling condition? And that is a condition that qualifies in one of two ways. Either the condition is going to last for at least 12 months, or the condition is likely to result in someone passing away. So, for instance, if you had a condition such as a broken leg that was expected to heal up within 6 months, that would not count. Nevertheless, a condition like MS, like diabetes, like many other conditions, would count and would be considered for disability. Notably, Social Security will consider multiple conditions in the same application. So if you have a combination of impairments that puts you over the threshold for disability, they will consider them in total, not just individually. If you show you have sufficient disabling condition, the standard they look to apply them to is your work history. And more specifically, in your work history, they want to go ahead and identify that you have enough work history to qualify for the insurance program. So they have what's called a quarter system. And that's a system where they try to value the work you've done over your life. And you have to show you've done enough work lifetime and enough work recently. These tests are designed to be very, very favorable for individuals. They're not designed to keep people from applying for disability. They're designed to have low allowance levels. For instance, a 50-year-old individual for the lifetime work test would have to work for about 7 years to qualify over the course of their lifetime. So someone who has gone to college, earned a degree, and started to work during that period, and maybe taken some time off to raise children or something of that nature, they're typically still going to pass the lifetime work test. In addition, however, and this is very important for MS patients, you also have to show you have sufficient recent work, which is generally viewed as work for 5 of the previous 10 years or 20 of the previous 40 quarters. Now, a year of work is a fairly low standard, typically around $6,000 per year. But a person who has left work to, say, raise their child through age 6 or something of that nature, and attempt to go back to work when their child turns 6, and then finds they can't do it because their disability is increased with MS, they may have issues qualifying for disability because, again, you have to have worked 5 of the 10 years before your disability began. However, that is before your disability began, not necessarily the date you applied. So if you leave work and wait several years before applying for disability, even though your medical records reflect you're disabled, you may be able to show you're qualified within that time period. But again, you've got to show you have a sufficient disabling condition and a sufficient work history, both lifetime, which is a fairly low standard, and recent, which is generally viewed as 5 of the previous 10 years. When they look at the disabling condition, they look for different work they can apply it to, because a diagnosis does not equal disability. Limitations due to a diagnosis are what equals disability. Generally, they apply those limitations to a 2-step work history test. First, they look at your work in the 15 years before you became disabled and ask if you can do any of those jobs you've done. So someone who has had a history of work as, say, a construction worker would have a relatively easy time showing they can't do this kind of work. So they may have an easy time for part one of this test. Conversely, someone who has a history of work in a sleep study would have a very difficult time passing this test because it's difficult to show you can't work as a sleep study participant. Nevertheless, if you show you can't do your prior work, they then move to an age-based standard using what we call fictional work. And they use an age-based standard because it favors those who have paid more into the system and will take from the system for a shorter period of time. So for those who are relatively young and under age 50, the test is, can you do any work whatsoever on a full-time basis, regardless of the amount that job pays, regardless to an extent of your training for that specific position? Because they will look at incredibly simple jobs here. That includes jobs such as a ticket taker at a movie theater, a greeter at a grocery store, a video surveillance monitor, where the main requirements are, can you attend work? Can you maintain focus for 8 hours a day? Can you stay at your post for 8 hours a day? For a person under age 50 with MS, we find that some of the major factors are things like fatigue, where a nap is required, bladder issues, where stepping away from your post and using the restroom is a major issue, things of that nature. For an under 50 applicant, mobility issues are less important because they will look at sit-down jobs. They will be considered, but they're less important. If you're over the age of 50 and you show you can't do your prior work in the last 15 years, the test is, can you do what's called light-duty work? And probably the best explanation of light-duty work is a cashier. You're on your feet all day, you're using your hands, you're maintaining focus, but you're not walking around constantly, you're not going up and down steps, you're doing heavy lifting. If you're over age 50, that's the type of job they typically look at. For a person over 50, obviously fatigue and bladder issues are important, but this is where mobility issues and leg strength issues become very important, as well as manual dexterity issues like that. So typically for a person over 50, we focus on fatigue, bladder, as well as gait-type issues as well. For a person who is over age 60, again, you've paid into the system for a long period of time if you're that person, and you're not going to collect for very long because when you reach full retirement age, your disability benefits convert to retirement benefits. So for that person over age 60, it's a relatively easy standard. And they ask, one, can you do your prior work in the past 15 years? And if you show you can't, they look at, can you do medium-duty work? Medium-duty work is partially defined by persistent lifting of 50 pounds. So if you picture a 60-year-old individual and picture a 50-pound bag of factory concrete mix or something like that in front of them, and ask them to pick that up and put it on a table, then take it off the table, then put it back on, and repeat this every 15 minutes for an 8-hour day. It's a relatively difficult thing for a young person to do who is relatively healthy, let alone someone with a major condition. So the focus for a claim for someone over age 60, typically, is their past work in the past 15 years. Again, they take any conditions, any symptoms you allege, and they apply it to your workability. Because for Social Security, it's not your diagnosis. It's the symptoms from your diagnosis and how it limits your ability to actually work. Now, MS does have a special qualification called a listing. And a listing is essentially a backdoor way for the SSA to say, we know that what's going on is somewhat unique for you. So therefore, we're going to give you a bit of a different analysis here to show the judges that your complaints are somewhat unique. And these focus on issues with MS that are different from a typical back or knee injury that a judge would see on a typical basis. For instance, when an MS patient says they're fatigued, it means something very, very different than when a typical disability applicant or person says they're fatigued. For you to show that you qualify under fatigue, you have to show significant reproducible fatigue on examination. Essentially, your neurologist or someone like them has to run testing that shows fatigue creeps up very quickly on examination on multiple exams. They also look at what they call disorganization of motor function. And that is a long way of saying two of your limbs don't work. Someone who uses, say, a rollator or a walker would have a good claim under this. If there's tremors or persistent numbness in the hands, again, that would be a good claim under this listing because it means that two of your limbs don't work in a reasonably functional way. They also look at visual impairment. Those who have optic neuritis or similar issues that have a permanent impact that cause your vision to be below 2200 or worse, may qualify very quickly as having a visual impairment that qualifies. They also note as a special listing mental impairments. And mental impairments are somewhat difficult to define, but they note that it results in a marked restriction of the activities of daily living. There's a lot of play in that language as far as how a judge interprets it. What I typically find for the listings is judges don't so much point to the listing and say, I'm approving you because of this listing. But I find that judges give a person a lot more credibility when they make arguments under these listings that we then apply to the typical test. Because the tests we talked about a moment ago, that you can see here, focused on your prior work and age-based fictional work, you're going to use a lot of these arguments you see here under listing to show you can't do that kind of work. And in my experience, it's easier to show a judge that when you say fatigue, it means something different because of these listings that are here. Nevertheless, from time to time, a judge will approve an MS claim directly under the listing, making things notably easier for a claimant. That is the essence of what the SSA looks at in a disability claim as far as the conditions and the work and the listings for an MS claim. Now, as far as timelines go and filing procedure, you can file online, in person, or via phone. And each of these methods have advantages and disadvantages. But we strongly suggest that MS patients file online. And frankly, my office files every claim we do online. And we suggest that for this reason. If you file with the SSA in person or via phone, one, they're hard workers, but they're often understaffed and overworked. And the quality of what they're typing into their system may not be as good as what you would type into the system if you were doing it on your own. Similarly, the last box they have to type in after Social Security Administration, if you file in person or via phone, are their reflections on your claim, if they notice anything unusual. And again, because of time considerations, we oftentimes find that box is not checked, or is checked to say essentially everything appeared normal. We have found judges from time to time will look at that and allege that you're not telling me all these problems are going on, yet the only person we had look at you face-to-face said there was nothing wrong. There weren't difficulties in you applying. So an online application we find is much more organized and much more thorough. So we do suggest that, and as I said, when my office files our applications, we always do it online if we can. We also strongly suggest when you file a claim, especially if it's done in person or via phone with the FSA, that you are well prepared to do that. And there are two forms the FSA requires during the disability process. You see them noted down below, the work history report and the adult function report. And those two forms provide significant information on the jobs you've worked and what they require, as well as your doctors and things of that nature. If you're going to file in person or on phone, that may be a handy set of documents to have with you to try to avoid having that phone call drone on and on and you having to sit there and remember almost off the top of your head what doctors you saw, when you saw them, what they're doing for you. Again, better submissions give better results. The more thorough you can be in giving them information, the more thorough they can be in properly applying that information and giving you the best chance you can to get approved there. Whenever we do an application, we get the forms ahead of time so we can do that and look at any issues before the application is filed. As far as the process itself, once you've gone ahead and filed the claim, you're going to start having contact with the adjuster and through letters and calls and things like that. If you have an attorney, your attorney should be handling these issues. They get paid to make your life easier, so they should be talking to the adjudicator. They should be reviewing these letters and keeping you in the loop, but handling those kinds of issues. If you go through this on your own, you want to make sure that you're responsive. One of the main issues the adjudicators have is people who are, to one extent or another, ignoring the request for information, for documentation. They can only operate with the information you give them. So if you don't give them a certain doctor's name or a proper timeline, they literally can't get the information they need. We note that a lot of times the FSA gives a relatively short timeline. We see a certain letter that says there's a 5 or 10 day return period. And by the time they mail it to you, you've almost worn through that entire period. We suggest that folks, number one, keep the envelopes they get and look at the dates they were mailed because the date of mailing doesn't always match the date of the letter itself. And we also suggest if you're handling a claim on your own, call the adjuster if you're running late. If you need an extra day because you have an exacerbation or it's been hot out and you're having difficulty functioning, call the adjuster. Give them 20 seconds and say, I received your letter. I see the deadline. Can I have an extra couple of days? They will almost invariably say that is okay. So you must be responsive, and don't panic with timelines. Just coordinate with the adjuster if you're going to run long on things. At the initial level, we're finding that as time goes by, they're requesting what are called consultative examinations more and more. And the consultative examination process is essentially the FSA's way of saying, we have some data, but we don't have enough records here to make a decision. We want one of our guys to take a look at you. It is not the best process, but it is what they ask and it is what they require, so you have to work with them on it. We suggest that clients try to give the doctor as much information as possible at the exam, answer questions thoroughly, and also note the duration of the examination. We had a client just recently who went to one of these exams, and it lasted, as she looked at her watch, 6 minutes. And it is nearly impossible to get a thorough neurological examination in 6 minutes. Because she documented that and documented the testing, we were able to notify the FSA of this issue, and they were able to respond to it. So you just want to do some common sense things like this if you're handling that on your own. Typically, from when you do the initial filing to when you get the first decision from the FSA is about 4 to 6 months. It can be quicker. We had a decision last week, I believe, that was 21 days, which is the record for our office. But for the typical case, we tell our clients to plan for 4 to 6, and we quietly hope for a period of 3 to 5 for a first decision. Now, in that first level, what percentage of disability claims are approved at the initial stage? 14%, 52%, 36%, or 25%? Folks did fairly well. The answer here is 36%. So while you kind of hit in the middle there between the 25%, 36%, it is not a guarantee that you're going to be approved or a guarantee you'll be denied. They approve about 36%. And you want to remember that some of the folks who get denied file over and over again. So that number is a bit higher for folks on first application who have a good claim. We find that if you've taken the time to file an initial claim, and if you think you truly are disabled, an appeal is appropriate of a disability denial. Frankly, that's why the appeal process exists. However, you have only 60 days to appeal if you're denied, so you must act promptly. And you can do this online, or you can do it on paper, or if you have counsel do it, they'll know how to do it as well. In most states, when you file an appeal at the administrative level, you go through what's called reconsideration. That period takes about 1 to 9 months, and it's essentially the initial level all over again. They take your file, give it to someone else, and say, review this, and make the right decision on it. As you can guess, the reversal rate's not too high at that point. Back in 2010, the reversal rate was around 8%. Because of that, several states, including Pennsylvania and a lot of states in the Northeast, have gone away from the reconsideration process and just dump it entirely. It's not a good use of funds. We do have some clients who are reversed on reconsideration. We're happy to have that, but we don't typically plan on that. It's just an extra step you got to go through. If you're denied at reconsideration, or if you don't have reconsideration, you then go to the hearing level. And that's an actual hearing in front of a judge. The catch is, it is a 15-month wait, typically, from when you request the hearing to when you get in front of a judge. So if you take 5 months for a first decision, you take, say, 3 months for reconsideration, and 15 months to get in front of a judge, this could easily become a 2-year process. And I tell you folks that not to scare you, but you should be educated so you can plan accordingly. The hearing is your best chance at approval. All the statistics reflect that. And frankly, it's your only chance to meet the decision maker face to face and actually tell them what's going on and answer questions they may have. At the hearing level, and I'm not here to sell you a service or anything like that, I'm here to provide you with information. We strongly recommend you have counsel at this stage. It is just too fast moving of a procedure and a little bit too technical to do on your own. Frankly, I compare it to a wedding. A wedding isn't rocket science, but we all know from our wedding days it goes by incredibly quickly, and you kind of miss the forest for the trees. That's how a hearing generally works. We also suggest that you get counsel earlier on, although I can understand if you don't. But frankly, we find that we do provide a service with value, and we do suggest it earlier on. But again, at the hearing stage, you certainly want someone there with you. Judges are randomly assigned, and the approval rate varies dramatically. One of the local offices we have here in Elkins Park, the approval percentage for judges varies from 76% to 38%. Same pool of clients, same law, different interpretation. One's not necessarily wrong, one's not necessarily right, but it's different interpretation. You don't know that until a couple of months before the hearing who you get. Again, having an attorney who knows those tendencies and things like that can make a fairly big difference there. If you're denied by a judge, there are areas for further appeal. However, they're very difficult. Judges are given great deference. You have to show a legitimate error by that judge. They pointed to facts that don't exist, or something dramatic of that nature. Theoretically, there's several appeals that you can do, but typically, we don't recommend that to our clients in the rare event they're denied. If a person's denied, one thing they may want to look at is filing a brand new claim. If you do that, you give up some of the time that you could otherwise request if you appealed. However, in a fresh claim, you may get access to a judge who is more favorable. You may have better information at that point because your condition's changed. Now, you want to check some timelines because there are limitations as to when you can file a new claim, but you do want a way, oftentimes with counsel, whether a further appeal is appropriate after the hearing or whether a new claim is appropriate. Now, if you've gone through this process and if you're approved at some point, there's really two things you're going for under SSDI. Number one is you're going for monthly payments. And these payments are based upon your earnings history. We've seen them vary anywhere from about $600 a month up to $2,600 a month. They vary dramatically, just as people's wages vary dramatically. You can go online to the website, ssa.gov. That's ssa.gov. And there's a portal you can access there to get an estimate of your disability benefit. It is notable that the monthly payments for disability have a 5-month waiting period. So from the date when your disability began, you do not get benefits for the first 5 months. You also get access to Medicare, the same program that retired folks get access to. However, there is a 29-month wait from when you qualify for disability to when Medicare will kick in. You want to keep that in mind as well. You also have opportunities to supplement your income if you're approved for SSDI. And Amy's going to get into that in depth shortly here as far as work eligibility, income limits, and things like that. There's also a sister program I'll touch on very briefly here. Federal programs are SSDI, which we talked about throughout here, and there's also supplemental security income. Supplemental security income is for folks without the proper work history. Picture a minor who is not able to take a job. Picture a housewife or somebody who's left work for more than 5 or 10 years. They may be looking at this program. The medical requirements are the exact same as SSDI. They have a sufficient disabling condition, things of that nature. Also, they look at your assets and your income. Your income has to be essentially zero. The assets have to be relatively minimal. So SSI is out there primarily for folks with little other option. If you're approved for SSI, you get monthly payments, and you get Medicaid eligibility, which, again, is not the greatest program out there, but it is certainly better than nothing. That covers my portion of this discussion, covering SSDI and SSI benefits, and some of the nuts and bolts of the initial application process, from filing the initial claim to filing appeals, percentages, timelines, and what the SSA looks for in approving or denying disability claims. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Jamie. That was such great information. We will now turn the floor over to Amy for the second part of our presentation. Amy, it's all yours.
Great. Thank you, Christina. Good evening, everybody. I am going to talk about how employment impacts your benefits once you're employed. So once you receive the SSI or the SSDI, what happens to the benefits? I'm also going to give a few resources. And so I wanted to start with the Work Incentive Planning and Assistance Program, or WIPA. This was a program that's been created and funded by Social Security. It's been around for many years, and it provides free services to SSI and SSDI beneficiaries across the country. Every zip code across the country has a certified benefits counselor, or what's called a community work incentive coordinator, to assist someone with what happens when you go to work and what's going to happen to my benefits. We help you understand and use work incentives. I'm going to touch briefly on a few of them and how they can be used to help you become more financially independent while you're working. And we are an independent voice. Although we are funded by Social Security, the WIPA is, we do not work for Social Security. We are trained in Social Security's rules and regulations so that we can be an advocate for the people that we work with who are receiving benefits. And so who do we serve? So WIPA will serve individuals who receive SSI or SSDI, either Social Security benefits, and are between the ages of 14 and full retirement age. A higher priority is given to those who are working and transitioning youth. Social Security is really focusing on those two groups, along with some others, such as veterans and those who are actively pursuing employment to provide services. However, a WIPA will serve anybody who is receiving a benefit and meets these criteria. And so what does a WIPA do? We offer information and referrals, so we can provide you just a general overview of the benefits and referrals to other agencies in your local area that you might need assistance with, such as food stamps or housing or other things. We also will provide a benefit summary and analysis, which is a written document after we have verified some of your benefits and some of your work goals, and we will provide that in writing to you and then go over it with you in detail about what the impact of your specific situation is and your employment will have on your benefits. We also provide problem solving and advocacy and then benefits management. So if you're working and there are certain critical points where you need to reach back out to Social Security to report something, we're going to be able to assist you with that. And so that's kind of what WIPA does. And once, for those of you who are looking at the screen, and once the slides come out tomorrow, there I have put some links at the bottom, some websites where you can find additional information about WIPA. So just very briefly, as Jeannie went over how to get on the program, the definition of disability for both SSI and SSDI that Social Security is looking at when you initially apply and then once you're working, they will look at this for work incentives, is the inability to engage in what's called substantial gainful activity, or SGA, by reason of any medical, physical, and or mental or blind impairment. And it has to have lasted or be expected to last 12 months or result in death. And so as far as once you are working, so what is this SGA level? So SGA is the basic test that's used by Social Security to establish disability status. So that's the inability to work at that level. You are then potentially qualified for that benefit. There's a dollar number that's attached to it. It's usually determined to be gross earnings, so before any money is taken out, it changes each year. The SGA levels set usually January 1st of each calendar year. Right now, that SGA level is $1,130. And for someone who meets the statutory blindness criteria, it's $1,820. And so what this means is this is the dollar number that Social Security is now going to look at when someone returns to work to determine whether or not you may or may not be eligible for your benefit. And so we'll look at a few work incentives that we'll use. They will be looking at that SGA level more carefully. And so I wanted to give you just kind of a brief overview chart of the different work incentives that are out there. And so for SSDI, there's something called the trial work period, the extended period of eligibility. There are special rules for the blind. There's a continuation of Medicare. For SSI, you'll see continuation of SSI, the student earned income exclusion. There's a blind work expense. There's something called 1619A and 1619B. There's property essential for self-support or a test plan. And then there's a plan for achieving self-support, or you'll hear PATH plan. I'm not going to have time to go into all of these in detail, but I just wanted you to see that there are multiple protections and work incentives out there that you may be able to use. And then there are some more that are for both SSI and SSDI. So if you receive either benefit, you may be able to use the impairment-related work expense, Section 301, subsidies, ticket to work, and expedited reinstatement. I wanted to start just very briefly just to alert you of a couple of SSI work incentives. And there's one called the Student Earned Income Exclusion, and this is for young people under the age of 22 who are regularly attending school. And it allows some of their earnings to be excluded when Social Security does the SSI calculation. And so a young person under 22 who's in school regularly can earn up to $1,780 monthly or maximum yearly amount of $7,180, and their SSI will not be impacted. And so it's a pretty great work incentive for that young person who may be trying to save money or has to pay for tuition or other items. And so I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail, but I just wanted to let you know that that's there. And Also, on Social Security's website, almost all of the work incentives that I'm going to talk about, there's a spotlight. So if you go to ssa.gov, in the right-hand corner, there's like a little search button. And if you type in spotlight on student earned income exclusion, it's going to give you a great two-page two-page information about the student earned income exclusion and each one of these work incentives. The other SSI work incentive, just briefly, I wanted to mention, is called 1619B. And a lot of times, someone who is receiving SSI who goes to work has concerns about the Medicaid. It's more about that Medicaid than the cash payment. 1619B is a protection from Medicaid. It allows someone who continues to meet all the other eligibility requirements for SSI to maintain that Medicaid in their state. And this is across the country. Every state has 1619B. Almost all states, it's automatically done. There are a few states where it's not automatic and you actually have to apply for 1619B. And then there's a special threshold that's used to measure earnings that each state will have, and that threshold also varies. But it allows someone to maintain that Medicaid even if they're not getting a cash payment, an SSI cash payment due to work. Okay, now I want to switch hats a little bit and talk just briefly about SSDI and a few work incentives that belong to the SSDI program. So for anybody who receives SSDI, there are three protections in place in this program. And the first one, it's called a trial work period, or you'll hear TWP. And this is really full protection. It is 9 months that do not have to be consecutive, where you have the ability to test being able to be at work without fear of losing your SSDI check. It must be completed within 60 months in order for Social Security to say that you've used your trial work period. If you don't complete it in 60 months or that 5 years, it's a rolling 60 months, so it just moves ahead until you get all 9 months within that 60-month period. And there's a dollar number that Social Security is going to look at. And in 2016, the trial work level is $810 in gross wages. And so if you go back to work and you're earning less than $810, absolutely nothing is happening to that SSDI check. If you begin to earn over $810, it doesn't matter if it's $825 or $10,000 in a month, you're going to use that trial work month. And you have 9 of those to test your ability to work. You'll keep that SSDI check. Once that trial work period is done, you will immediately enter what's called an extended period of eligibility, or you'll hear EPE. This extended period of eligibility is a 36-month consecutive month that follows that trial work period, immediately follows it, so you can count out those 36 months. During this period, you may or may not be eligible for your SSDI check, depending on what your earnings level are. This is when Social Security will now go back and look at that SGA level. They're going to look to see, are you earning SGA now, which is currently $1,130. If you're earning less than $1,130, you would still keep your SSDI check, nothing happened. If you're earning over $1,130, and this is countable income, not gross, then you'll be, you would not be entitled to your SSDI check if you're earning over that. And so during this 3-year period, you're still on the SSDI program. You just may or may not be getting a check, and you may go in and out of that cash payment status depending on your earnings. The third work incentive for anybody on SSDI is called expedited reinstatement, or you'll sometimes hear EXR. This happens after Social Security has terminated someone from SSDI. So the month that you're terminated, you would enter this expedited reinstatement period. It's a 5-year period of time. And during that period of time, if for some reason you are no longer able to work at the level that you're working at over SGA, you drop below that, your hours are cut, you have to stop working, you can, and it's due to your disability, it has to be due to your disability, you can request this expedited reinstatement. And what that does, it's a quicker redetermination. It's a quicker application process. You don't have to do a full application process. There is some paperwork. But while it's happening, Social Security will give you 6 months of your SSDI cash payment while they do that redetermination. And I've helped several people do it. It works. Usually it's 4 to 6 months approximately when they make the final decision. If they determine you are no longer eligible, even though you've applied through EXR, you don't have to pay back those 6 months of cash payment. Those are no strings attached while they do a redetermination. These three work incentives are available to every single person who's receiving SSDI. They are there for you to use. There are other work incentives that I'm going to briefly talk about a couple that you may or may not qualify for. And so it depends on your specific situation. And the first one I'm going to talk about is this impairment-related work expense. And this is both can be used both for someone receiving SSI and someone receiving SSDI or someone who's receiving both. So what it is, the purpose of the IRWI is it's used to allow beneficiaries who might be receiving SSI to reduce their gross income and those who receive SSDI to reduce the SGA levels due to out-of-pocket expenses that support a disability and allow a person to earn income. Even if those items are services are not needed for work activities. So what does this mean? This essentially means if I'm paying for out-of-pocket expenses that are related to my disability, they support me being able to go to work, I can tell Social Security about them. They have to be related to the disability. So if I pay for co-pays for medication or a doctor visit, therapy, assistive technology, if I take specialized transportation, all of these things may count as an impairment-related work expense as long as I link it to my specific disability and that I'm paying for it out of pocket. So it's very simple. There is no form. But to report it to Social Security, what you would do is we recommend just a cover sheet that says I'm reporting wages and I'm reporting impairment-related work expenses of, $50, and here's my receipt in each month. So for someone who has a lot of expenses, this can reduce you below that SGA level and allow you to keep your SSDI check. For someone on SSI, it allows you to capture some of that expense back in your SSI check. And so other examples would be if you have a service animal, personal care assistant, anything you're paying for out of pocket. And the regulations are real gray. So we've helped several people do some unique things based on their specific situation. Another work incentive that can be for both SSI and SSDI is called a subsidy and or special condition. And for SSI, this can only be used during the eligibility process. And so what it would do for SSI is if I'm initially applying for that SSI benefit and I'm working and I'm earning a certain level, if I'm getting support from either a job coach or the employer has provided some additional support, it can reduce my income below the SGA level so that I would qualify for SSI. So that's the only time you can use a subsidy from the SSI side. So primarily for SSDI, once I'm working, this can be used, again, it can be used during the initial eligibility process, as well as to allow someone to keep their income below the SGA while you're working. And so what Social Security will do is they're going to look for evidence of there's extra support somehow. So has the employer have built-in supports for someone, or is there extra supervision? Is the expectation that I'm doing, I have lower productivity, I don't have to meet quite as much quota or goals or whatever it might be. There's a difference in job functions from other coworkers in the same position, and I'm getting paid the same amount. What Social Security will do is look at that. There's a form that can be completed by the employer to evaluate that, and Social Security will not look at a certain percentage of my income to determine whether I'm going to be at that SGA level. It can be directly from the employer. It can be if I have a job coach and I'm not even paying for it, but I have a job coach through a different agency. If I have self-employment supports, all of these things can be looked at and potentially be a subsidy. And that's where having a benefits counselor through WIPA or through another resource can assist you with applying for and submitting the appropriate paperwork to Social Security. And then Ticket to Work. So the Ticket to Work program, most people have heard of it. It's been around for a long time. It's a voluntary program for people with disabilities who want to go to work. The person has to receive SSI or SSDI cash payment, and you have a ticket that can be used. It allows you greater choice of who you work with as a service provider. When you assign your ticket, and let me just say, you don't physically have a ticket. It's linked to your Social Security number. And so, but when you assign this ticket to an agency, you are protected from medical reviews that happen every so often by Social Security if you're meeting timely progress. And timely progress just has to do with the amount of work you're doing, how much you're getting paid. If you're in school, it can be a combination of things. So as long as you're making timely progress towards working your way off benefits, then you potentially will have you'll be protected from having these medical reviews done. The Ticket to Work program is across the country and its territories. The National Program Manager for Social Security is Maximus. So you may receive letters from Maximus about Ticket to Work periodically. And then what happens is Social Security qualifies agencies, they're called employment networks, to provide employment services to individuals who want to assign their ticket to that agency. And so they're a contractor with Social Security, and they can be a state vocational rehabilitation agency. They can also be a private company. They can be a nonprofit. I've seen universities. Really, there's a lot of different employment networks out there, and they all do different things. And so if you wanted to take advantage of this program, I encourage you to look at the Ticket to Work website. Again, it's choosework.ttw.net, and you can plug in your zip code, and it will give you a whole list. That's where you can find WIPA, but you also can find the employment network. It'll give you a whole list of agencies, a contact name and phone number and email and all of that information. It'll tell you what their specialties are, if they have any. You can actually look at their scorecard to see, you know, how they're rated. You can find out a lot of information on there. What I will suggest that, too, is when you start to call some of these agencies, you want to ask them very specific questions about, you know, what are the services you provide and what you can do, you know, what can you do for me, and this is my situation, because they all do different things, and it is voluntary both ways. So you can say, well, I really want to assign my ticket to agency A, but agency A may say, we're not going to accept your ticket. We don't think you're the best fit for us. So it does go both ways, so just so you know that. But there's a whole host of information on that website that can provide you more information. And then just briefly, I wanted to touch on reporting wages. So it's very, very important once you start working, if you're receiving a cash benefit, that you report wages. And we recommend that you report wages by the 6th of each month. And you're going to hear different things from the local Social Security offices, or if you call the call center, the national 1-800 number, about reporting wages. Technically, the law is you should be reporting every month. Now, it may or may not make a difference in your actual cash payment depending on your earnings level. But there are really three ways to report. You can report in person by going to your local field office. You want to make sure you ask for a receipt, and then you want to keep that receipt. And if you go in person, I always recommend bring the copies of your pay stubs. If you bring a cover sheet that just says I'm reporting wages for March and you have your date on there and your Social Security number on there, make a copy of that cover sheet. Give Social Security the pile with the pay stubs in the cover sheet. Your second cover sheet, they can actually date stamp it and initial it, and that will count as a receipt, and then you don't have to wait for them to go back and print out a letter. You can also report by faxing it in and then print that fax history as a receipt. I will tell you, you will not find the fax number for the local office anywhere on Social Security's website, but I will tell you your WIPA should have those fax numbers and should be able to share those with you. And then the third way is through mail, and we highly recommend you use tracking just because mail sometimes gets lost. It gets set on someone's desk. And you want the proof that you sent in the information when you were supposed to send it in. These are the three main ways. I prefer faxing, if at all possible, because it gets in quicker and it's easier to have that history, that fax history, if you have the availability and the capability to do fax. There are a couple of additional ways to report, but it's only for SSI. There's a special number, a 1-800 number, that's open from the 1st through the 6th of each month. And I put the number here. It's 866-772-0953. It's automated, so what you're doing is punching in your income for the month. And then there's an SSI mobile wage reporting app as well. And so if you receive SSI or you work with people who receive SSI, I highly recommend this. One of these two ways is the best way to do it because it's automated. You don't have to actually wait for a claims representative at Social Security to input the information. It automatically goes into their system. It's supposed to generate a receipt. I find 50-50 chance that you actually will get a receipt in the mail. And so what we recommend and what I would recommend is if you do it by the phone or you do it by the mobile app, you follow up with faxing or mailing it in. With the mobile app, you can actually, if you can take a screenshot of your mobile app at the last page, it'll say it's submitted and completed. You can take a screenshot of that and save that then as your receipt. And so really important to get the information in because for SSI, your income's going to be impacted immediately. For SSDI, depending on if you've used trial work months or if you're in the extended period eligibility, where you're at, it can trigger whether or not you're eligible for that SSDI check. And then I have just a few resources for you. I put in Social Security's information. There's something called the Red Book, which has, you can get a physical copy of it, but it's also in a PDF on Social Security's website. It's all about the work incentive. So every single work incentive that Social Security has is in that book. And so if you're trying to develop something at the local office and you're having trouble, I always tell someone to bring that Red Book in with you so they can see their own publication. Because not everybody's trained in all of those work incentives that you may have to deal with at the local office. There's a great PASS website for anybody who is SSI and interested in that plan to achieve self-support. And then I've got the ticket to work and the WIPA information here. And I'm going to turn it now back over to Christina.
Great. Thank you so much, Amy and Jamie, both of you, for such great information. I'm going to now change it over to our Q&A session. And for those of you on the computer, you can pose your question in the chat feature on the left side of the screen. And for those of you who are participating by phone, you'll have an opportunity to pose any questions through a dedicated email that we will share at the end of the presentation. So the first question we have is from an individual who states that she is 62 and receives SSDI. She understands it will automatically convert to retirement benefits when she turns 66. Will I continue to receive the same dollar amount, or will it increase or decrease? I have been contributing to Social Security system since I was 16 years old.
Great. So if 66 is the full retirement age for her, then it should flip over and it should be the same amount. However, if she has been working in the past few years, depending on what the income is, Social Security is going to do a calculation to see if it should be higher. but you can expect it to be the same at that time.
Great, thank you. Next question is the SGA an annual amount or a monthly amount?
Oh, sorry, it is a monthly amount, so $1,130 countable income in 1 month.
Great, thank you. And then we have a question that says, how serious does the judge take the consultation exam?
It depends on the judge. We find many judges understand the limitations of that brief one-time evaluation, especially compared to ongoing neurological or physical therapy care. If you have a qualified and skilled attorney, we can point out what's going on, including by getting basic information, the doctor's qualifications, which aren't always provided. And sometimes they have a doctor who is a general family doctor who they're presenting as an expert against your neurologist's recommendation. So the judges typically understand the limitations there. And if you give a skilled response with good information in favor of your claim, it can make a difference.
Okay, great. Thank you. Next question is, can you still be working while you file your claim?
The short answer is yes. And I think Amy touched on this some earlier. It's with limitation. You can't be working full-time over certain amounts, but you can work some, and it's generally not held against you if you're below certain limitations. Do you want to touch on those numbers briefly, Amy?
Right. So if you're under SGA, you can be working and filing for that benefit. So that number is, again, $1,130 right now, and that changes yearly in January.
We also in my office have a rule of thumb we recommend that you stay below 25 hours a week, even if you're staying below SGA. If you're working 35 hours a week with low income, most judges will typically hold that against you in the claim process. So in addition to the financial numbers, you want to keep your hours below 25 or preferably below 20 if you are working.
Okay, great. Thank you. Another question is, I am 60 and currently working but struggling. How long do I have to be out of work before I file for disability?
You can file essentially immediately when you leave. And I saw a question noted as we were talking earlier. The condition has to last 12 months, but it doesn't have to be disabling for 12 months before you apply. So if you're diagnosed with MS and you have no issue, but you have a major exacerbation that knocks you out of work, you can apply technically the day after that exacerbation occurs. So as soon as you leave the workforce, you can apply. Typically, I suggest you wait a couple of weeks just to make sure your body doesn't bounce back, that the steroid treatment or whatever it is they give you doesn't put you back on your feet. But legally speaking, you can technically apply the day after you leave work. There's no waiting period required for an application.
Great. Thank you. There's a question that says, SSDI allows 1130 max to earn at work. Does that reduce the amount of the SSDI payment, or does it remain the same?
It will remain the same. So that's the payment amount of the SSDI amount is going to be based on your work history. So it doesn't matter what your income is from employment. It will stay the same.
Great, thank you. And along those lines, well, part of what you said in the answer is, you know, how are the payments calculated? Are they set or can they vary in payments was another question that came in.
Yeah, I think Jamie touched on this a little bit too. So the payments vary depending on the work history. So the way I compare it is someone who has a long work history and has a high wage earner is going to have a much higher SSDI check than someone who has a short history of employment and maybe earning less. So it varies.
Great, thank you. Another question is there any time limit for receiving SSDI? Are there any medical or other tests that need to be done periodically to maintain benefits?
Not that need to be done. Now, some people posted on the comments here, they do a review of even approved claims every 2 or 3 years. And on the review, they typically look for ongoing treatment, ongoing medications, and continuing symptoms. And if you show those as an MS patient, they typically don't challenge your benefits. However, there are some tests out there that are excellent for MS purposes. If you're referred for a neuropsychological exam, that is an excellent way of proving cognitive issues. A functional capacity evaluation, especially by someone who knows MS, can also be an excellent source of information. So some tests are better than others, but on the review, what they typically look for and what they typically see are going to be just ongoing treatment, symptoms, and medication.
All right, great, thank you. Another question we have is, under assistive technology for IRWE, would that include durable medical goods and assistance to take care of other home activities that are no longer possible due to work outside of the home?
If you can link it back to being able to work, then the answer is yes, because it has to be related to work. So durable medical goods, absolutely, for what you would need to be working. So it really depends on your situation. For example, I have someone who she works from her home a few days a week, and then she goes in, and she has significant costs in those types of things. And we are able to actually get a lot of the stuff from home, but it has to be only for when she was actually working at home. So it can only be related to work. So anything related to work, you would be able to count.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have a question about, how do I go about proving my work history?
Generally, the SSA will ask you what jobs you've worked. They will compare that to your IRS earnings records and the wage reports that your employer gives to the state over time. So it's typically a fairly simple process. That where you run into issues, and I have a case like this that we're trying to manage currently, is say someone is a construction worker or someone is a waitress and they're paid under the table or something like that. Generally, they have issues getting credit for those wages, and it can cause serious issues in a disability claim. But for the vast majority of people who work for an employer who is on the level, they simply check your IRS earnings records, compare that to what you've stated your prior work was, and it's as simple as that.
Great. Thank you. If you return to work after being on SSDI and later you have to go back on SSDI, will you go back to the original benefit amount, or will it be based on the most recent work period?
So Social Security is going to look at what your most recent work is. I can tell you, and Jamie, you can answer if you know, too, but I know that it doesn't go up a whole lot, you know, unless you've had a really significant increase in salary for a year or two, and then you go back on it. They will look at that work history.
It's also age-based to an extent. If you're 58 years old and you go back to work for a year or two, you're not going to be able to push that number too much because you've already done the heavy lifting as far as earnings go. If you are 23 years of old and you try going back to work, that's a dramatically different story because it is weighted based upon your age.
Great. Thank you. Another question is, what are typical charges for an attorney to process a Social Security claim?
The typical charges are almost standard across the industry there, and they're set by statute. Almost all attorneys will charge 25% of the past due benefit if you're approved for disability. So if you're not approved and you don't get benefits, no attorney should get a dollar from you. But if you apply for disability and you're approved, they will pay you benefits to bring you up to date, and then they will pay you benefits on a monthly basis going forward. The typical attorney's fee is based solely upon the benefits paid in a lump sum to bring you up to date, and they're almost always 25% of that amount.
Thank you. Is the start date of disability retroactive? In other words, if you file your claim in June of 2016 and are approved on 9/2017, is your start date of filing or the date of approval?
It's the date when you allege your disability began, typically. So if I have an exacerbation January 1st, and I don't apply until June 1st because I hope I'll get better. I can tell Social Security my disability began in January, and Social Security can say my disability began in January. They may also look at my filing and say, you weren't really disabled in January, but there's a second exacerbation you had in March. That's the date your disability began. So they can pick an earlier date. The one catch is they can only go back about 18 months before you file your claim as far as benefits go. So if I have an exacerbation, say, back in 2008, but I don't get around to applying until now for some reason, even if our medical records and the FSA says, yes, you were disabled in 2008, my benefits still wouldn't go all the way back to that time. They'd only go back about 18 months or so.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have another question of, how can we tell if we've used any of our trial work period or the extended period, and how much, if any, remains?
Great. So one thing you can do is if you look at your income and you know what you've earned each month, I mean, that's the best way to figure it out. There's also a report that you can request directly from Social Security. It's called a benefit planning query, and it should be free to someone who receives SSI or SSDI. And it will show you on there, it'll tell you your date of eligibility, the amount you're receiving, but it will show on the second or third page, it's going to show you your trial work period and if it's been used. It'll show date of cessation, which is the beginning of your extended period of eligibility. It'll show those things on there if it's up to date. And so a lot of times they're not up to date because Social Security hasn't entered the information in the system. So the best way is for you to be able to track it yourself or go back and look at your income. An easy way, you know, a general, quick, easy estimate way is take your yearly earnings divided by 12 and look to see whether you're over that trial work threshold for the year, the dollar number in that year.
And Christina, can I jump in and just add on to the question you asked a moment ago of me? As far as attorney's fees go, there's been a couple questions noted about long-term disability and Social Security disability. And long-term disability is a benefit you may get through your employer after you leave work or something like that. Most long-term disability plans require you to file for Social Security because it saves them money at the end of the day. And if you collect long-term disability while Social Security disability is pending and you're approved for Social Security, generally, the long-term disability insurance company will pay for your attorney's fee for Social Security no matter what attorney you get. A lot of folks don't know about that, but it's a little loophole they have there to the employee's benefit.
Thank you. We have another question. If I am terminated from my current full-time job, can I apply for Social Security disability while collecting unemployment?
Yes.
You want to be very careful with that, however, because different states have different rules as far as collection. And if you're under age 50, there can be a conflict between what you're telling unemployment and what you're telling Social Security, and some judges may hold that against you. If you're looking at doing that, especially if you're under age 50, you probably want to talk to counsel just to get more information from them first.
Okay, thank you. We have one question about if you are self-employed. Is the 1130 monthly your gross or your net income?
So self-employment is actually looked at differently by Social Security. Social Security is actually going to look at something called net earnings from self-employment, and what they do is they look at a yearly amount of income, and so and then they give you a calculation off of it. So they're not actually looking. They're going to look at your net income. So after all of your business expenses are taken off of your income, that net income, and they're going to multiply that by fraction that they do that by. That's called your net earnings from self-employment. Then they'll take that and they'll divide it by 12. Or if you know you only earn that within, you know, these 6 months, then we'll divide it by those 6 months, and from that, Social Security will then look to see if you're over the trial work level, if that's what they're looking at, or over the SGA level. the trial work, they also look at how many hours you are working and putting into your self-employment, into your business. They will count a trial work month if you're at that 810 or if you've worked 80 hours or more in a month. And so it really, they look at things differently. And so that's really, I would advise you to talk to a benefits counselor either in your area or, you know, reach out to me.
Great. Thank you. I think we have time for one more question. We have a lot coming in, but let's see here. I was diagnosed in 2004, but my overall appearance looks good. However, I suffer from fatigue and some cognitive issues. How will this affect the judge's decision if I don't look disabled?
The key in a claim like that, and frankly, most of our MS claims we have, here we do probably 40% MS work. Our typical claimant's a 45 to 55-year-old female who's had MS for 10 to 15 years. And these claimants generally look good compared to most disability applicants. We find that those cases require work before you walk into a hearing in front of a judge because that individual will not look as disabled as a typical applicant. Polishing up good medical records, getting good statements from the doctors, and frankly submitting a brief before the hearing. So the judge is told what to expect on the brief and what medical issues are there instead of getting the first impression when you walk in the door. So it's important that the attorney has dealt with MS before and knows how to handle these claims, which are very different in nature than a back injury or knee injury or something like that.
Great. Thank you so much. Laura, did you want to go over a little bit of the CanDo MS resources, and then we will jump back.
Absolutely. Christina, thank you for moderating, and I want to send out a huge thank you to Jamie and Amy for providing some invaluable information tonight. Thank you so much. As we conclude, I would like to inform you of some additional resources that you may find informative and helpful. On the CanDo MS website, mscandu.org, you will find some archived webinars, e-news, and library articles, including an article on managing your employability with MS. You can also submit questions to the Ask the CanDo team, which will be answered by our team of MS experts. Christina, did you want to share some of the national MS resources that are available?
Absolutely. Thank you. I want to take a moment just to highlight some of the resources that deal with employment. We have a variety of employment brochures, some of which you see there, including the Win-Win Approach to Reasonable Accommodations, Should I Work?, and some other titles that aren't listed here that have information for employers. Employment Matters is comprised of video segments about key employment issues and a toolkit on job searching. The website listed here, nationalmssociety.org/employment, is full of employment information, including disclosure, accommodations, and additional information on career change and resources. Also, just wanted to say, as I mentioned, there were a lot of questions coming in, and thank you again so much to Jamie and Amy for all of your knowledge and answering as many as you could. But if we weren't able to get to your question this evening, you can feel free to email your employment-related question to the email address listed here. And for those of you on the phone, it is employmentquestions@nmss.org, and we will follow up with you. And then lastly, one thing that we wanted to point out to everybody that March is MS Awareness Month, and the National MS Society is currently hosting the annual Public Policy Conference in D.C. right now, which is the largest lobbying event in the country focused on improving conditions for people living with MS. So thousands of people will be speaking with their lawmakers about increasing funding for MS research, improving the way we collect data and understand MS, and ensuring people can access affordable medications and health care. For more information and to see ways that you can become involved, please visit. There's websites listed on the slides there that you can get a lot more information on. Laura, I wanted to turn it over to you to see if there was any last comments that you had.
Absolutely. I want to remind everybody that this is a four-part series on employment issues with MS. The first two have been archived on our website, mscandu.org, so please view our website to review those presentations. This presentation will be archived on our website by the end of the day tomorrow. And finally, our fourth in our four-part series, which is entitled Home-Based Employment, What Employers Want, is scheduled for March 29th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And I do encourage you to join in. As always, you can register for the webinar and telelearning series free of charge on the CanDo MS website. And lastly, one thing that I do ask is for your feedback. At the conclusion of the webinar, a survey will appear on your computer screen. We do have a new survey format, so please take a moment to complete the survey and share your input. Your feedback helps us to continue to improve our webinar and telelearning series, and you will also receive a PDF copy of tonight's slides by email. Thank you, and have a great night. And again, a huge thank you to Amy and Jamie, as well as Christina, for participating and moderating and speaking in tonight's webinar. Thank you all.